I got Love my last
Talk
one.
Radio.
Okay. I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2650. Okay, we have a wonderful guest with us tonight. His name is Ed Squire. He's from Denver, Colorado, and he's quite the man to tell us a story about child abuse. However, before I get to that, okay, before we start talking, I do read the mission statement and speak a little bit about NASCA, okay? We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two different ways. Number one is educating the public, very important, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic. It's worldwide. We know this. We hear it every day on the news. We know this. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Prevention is very heavy with me. I think if neighborhoods and society became more involved with child abuse, if they had more education, they would be more apt to make phone calls, which need to be mated with child abuse. And just for your information, the 1-800-4-A-CHILD, that's 1-800-4-A-CHILD, is in the middle, actually, of our country, but they cover the whole region of everywhere. If you don't want to deal with police in your area or whomever, call that number. I called at 2 o'clock in the morning one night. Got a wonderful person on the phone. She helped. She was great. And they took care of business. Put it that way. Let's put it that way. Okay. So 1-800-4-A-CHILD. They have very good counselors there. And I'm a counselor, and I like to have very good counselors. Okay. So we also have Bill from California. He is called in. He is the founder of NASCA, and I'm going to bring him on. Oh, hello, Bill. Let me shut off my cell phone here. I'm sorry. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing well. My air conditioner is making a lot of noise, and I'm concerned you might be hearing it. Can you hear it?
No.
Okay.
No.
It's been good. That's a good thing. I just was concerned because they're making a racket here. I got to obviously get it serviced, but it's running for now. So thanks very much, guys, for being
okay.
Here. And, I'm here.
Yeah, we're going to have a good show here. We have a wonderful guest. And I just want to say, people out there, please, please do get involved with the NASCA website. That's NASCA.org. That's NASCA.org. There's a wealth of information. You just scroll down a little bit. You'll see menus drop down. You see red lines. You poke on to them, starting with programs at the left and go all the way over to the right. And you will find out tons of information about child abuse. So important. Okay, let's get to our guest here. His name is Ed Squire. He is from Denver, Colorado. And it says here, I'm only going to read one sentence. My father, his brothers and sisters were sexually abused as children by their stepfathers, And then he has Ed Reports, who was the same man that sexually abused me. Now, we're going to go from there. And from time to time, I will ask you questions. I had written to you how the, you know, how it works here and the format. And then also, too, maybe Bill might want to ask questions. And Adrian claims that she'd just like to, if she's in Pennsylvania, she'd like to listen tonight. Okay. So Bill and I guess, are going to be the ones that might be asking you questions. I'll give out the phone number here. It is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. So, Ed, go ahead and start telling us your story.
Oh, sure. Thank you very much for having me on the show, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. Quite a sentence hearing it back when somebody else reads it to me, and I'm, you know, wondering myself, did that really happen? And it did. So for, you know, I had a great childhood upbringing in many regards, because, you know, my mother and my father were never abusive to my only sister and I. And we had a place on the lake that we went to on the weekends, and we did everything together as a family. But there were things in my father's past and that had, you know, really influenced him. And he was sexually abused by his stepfather. And as I mentioned in that information there, he was his brother and brothers and sister was as well. And so for me, what happened was when I was at home being babysat by my grandparents when I was 4 years old and my parents were going off to work, both my sister and I were babysat by them. And when I would go for my afternoon nap, that's when my step-grandfather would come into my room and began. It was a slow process of grooming that took place, but it didn't take long. And when you're that old, or that young rather, for myself, you're just really unaware of what's going on, right? I can remember very clearly not really understanding what was happening, because you're just not developed emotionally and mentally and physically and psychologically in those ways. And so he would do this on a regular basis from age 4 to 7. And then one day, and feel free to interrupt me at any time if you have any questions. Then one day, the very last time that he had abused me was when he got caught in the act by my grandmother. So I was 7 years old at this time, and we were in the basement. And she had come down to see, you know, I don't know what she was looking for, seeing if we were ready for lunch or whatever, but she came downstairs and was horrified to see what was going on. Now, because she had witnessed these things, well, I don't know if she witnessed them, but she knew that he had been a molester in the past. She was in shock and horrified, and she screamed at him. And that was a shocking moment for me as well, because, I mean, talk about shame and fear and these things. So I remember running upstairs and out the back door and just hiding in the trees and the bushes behind our house. And then my grandmother and my step-grandfather were yelling and screaming and arguing at each other. And my sister was somewhere in the house at the time, and she didn't know what was going on. And she didn't know that I was hiding in the backyard or anything like that. And I kind of lost track of time. I didn't know how long I was there for. But I do remember that I wasn't going back into that house until my parents got home from work. And when they did, they came up the back steps and walked in the back door. And then I felt safe to come out from the bushes and go in the back door. And that's where the kitchen and our eating area was. And I remember very clearly that I was surprised that it was like nothing had happened. I guess even at that young, I was kind of hoping subconsciously that somebody would say or do something or, you know, stand up for me. And that would have been on my grandmother's, it would have been her responsibility to do that, because my parents wouldn't have known. And so that day just went by. And so I just kept it and buried it. I didn't say anything to anybody. And that was the last time that he abused me. And then
there for a second. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Now, you see, that's the last time he abused you. See, he got caught, okay, by family members. And so, therefore, then he stopped. I'm thankful that he stopped. It does say here that you were sexually abused until you were 10, okay, and you had just said 7 previously, and it was 3 different men. So we have quite a story to tell here. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. So, so it's interesting as I look back on my life and, you know, beginning to write about it and have a nonprofit and whatnot that we'll talk about later, but when you look back and process these things and see how they changed your life, it's quite significant and profound. So I understand, you know, how these things impact our brains, the way we think. I understand from a layperson's perspective the impact that it has in our development, in our maturity, our ability to process things as we grow older. And then you become this survivor of childhood sexual abuse as an adult. So back in those days, I started going to just before I went to go to elementary school, our next-door neighbors, their son, and we were good friends with them. My parents had been friends with them for many years. Then the neighbor's son was, I think he was about 16 or so, and he began molesting me as well, and it was in play. It was kind of like a playful kind of thing, you know. He would invite me over to play in the basement and these things. And it was another slow grooming thing. And so it was interesting because I was used to that. I had experienced this process, these weird feelings before. So it wasn't the first time, right? So it was just strange looking back at it. And so that went on for about a year. And I don't remember how many times he molested me, but it was many times. You just don't remember the numbers. And my parents never knew, and my mother, I think she and my sister are listening to the show tonight. She might be surprised. I can't remember if I told her this or not, so Mom, sit down and buckle in, and Wendy, help Mom out here. But sometimes that happened in our house. So he would stay overnight sometimes for a sleepover, and we would be in the bedroom, and it would happen even there. And so when that was over, and I don't remember the last time, I don't remember why it ended, it just did, and then elementary school started. And that was a whole different thing. So when I was in grade four, it was 4, 5, and 6, our teacher, grade 4 teacher, he was a pedophile. And so he began slowly grooming myself, other boys in the class, and you know how he did that was, you know, he's just the classic groomer and the classic pedophile, where everybody loved the guy and he was fun and funny and, you know, everybody felt safe. But you know, when the boys would go up to his desk to ask a question or get some help, he would put his arm around you and he would fondle you. And I remember very distinctly when that began to happen. It was so bizarre because now I'm 9 years old, 8, 9 years old. And I'm just very aware that, you know, this is not right. This is not good. But I felt, you know, I didn't know what to do about it. And I unbeknownst to me, this was happening to every single boy that would go up to his desk. And the boys that kind of pushed him off in a way, right, that made some kind of a reaction, to the best of my knowledge, he would stop pursuing them and stop grooming them. But he got to the point where the majority of the boys in the class, for the next 3 years that I was in that school, he successfully, you know, got us on his side, groomed us, and he was molesting us every day in school. And he would also invite us to his house after school, where he had this huge train set in his basement. And it was, they had paper mache mountains, and I mean, it was a beautiful, huge, you know, antique train set. So of course all of us boys, we loved it. So he would invite us to his house all the time, and he would molest us there as well. So this is a really big, you know, this isn't just my grandfather, it's not just the next door neighbor, now it's the teacher and all these boys. And
wow.
So you know, I had no idea how that would affect me or impact me. And so, I mean, that went on for 3 years, and then off I went to high school, you know, after grade 7, and there was no abuse happening in grade 7. But it profoundly impacted me as a young man going into high school and trying to figure out who I was, my identity, and all the things that are hard enough as a young person going through puberty and entering into high school. It was, looking back now, I can see how it was more difficult for me than it probably would have been otherwise.
Right. Let's stop there, okay? I want to bring in Bill and Adrian if she wants to speak. But before I do that, you had already a tremendous amount of, you know, sexual abuse, okay, before you even got into high school. I did too. I understand how that feels. And then there's so many people that, you know, do have trouble with all kinds of identity. They have identity issues, sexual identity issues, because of the same sex, you know, because you had men that were, or, you know, that were sexually abusing you. And that's a very difficult thing for a young person to try and process. In fact, I'm sure that many times when this first started way back when, you were probably, number one, very confused, of course, and then also scared. And then there are some times that, you know, children, and I don't want people to misunderstand this, but there are children at times they think it's a way of showing love, or they enjoy it because our body, it responds to the stimuli. And that has nothing to do with, you know, like a person then becoming like a homosexual or whatever, you know, becoming gay or anything like this. God made our body the way he did. Okay, let me go to Bill and see what he has to say about all of this. I'm really sorry you went through this. Go ahead, Bill. Sure.
Well, Carol just told all the things, you know, she knows my story so well, she just told it all. Kind of in how I felt, because I also was abused by men, all men, sexually. And in my case, it began before high school too, but it continued into high school with another group of men, just like you. The first man who abused me wasn't a teacher. Well, he was a teacher, actually, but I didn't meet him in his school. He was a high school teacher who, during the summers, was a camp counselor, and that's where I met him. And his grooming process included, instead of a model train set or something like that, it was photography, because he was also the camp photographer. And he took a lot of legitimate photographs at camp, but I almost right away became his little naked little boy model at age 11. And it lasted for the next two summers. So three summers in a row, he took thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures. And I did not even know what the word sex meant. Of course, I found out after the first summer when I went to grade school, and the kids in the playground would tell me stuff that really confused her and hurt me. That is where I found out about this thing called being a fag, or, you know, being gay. They didn't use the word gay, faggot, and that it was a shameful thing. Now, I want to say before I go any further to anyone who's listening, there's nothing wrong with anybody being gay, either male or female. But back then, in my immature mind, I was very fearful of people, you know, finding out, and then starting, and then I would be marked as that, and it was something that really scared me, actually, for the next almost 20 years. And then when I was finished with the three summers, he took me away and he kidnapped me, because my parents knew him very well. They let him, and he took me away for two or three weeks to New York City, to Vermont, to Canada. He took me on a trip where I didn't know where I was. I couldn't escape. My parents completely trusted the guy, so they weren't worried, and so forth. And only a few weeks after that finished, I found myself at a minor seminary, because I was thinking of being a priest in freshman year of prep school or the seminary school. And the priest that I told there turned out to be a pedophile too. And so, you know, then there was another priest who did exactly what your teacher did. He would always put his hands on me, and frequently while paying attention to the work I was doing and sort of pretending to look over my shoulder and be very interested in what I was studying, his hand would take mine and he'd press it down into my lap. So he'd be feeling my erection because, as Carol says, you know, the body is made to react, and mine certainly did. But I was terrified of being caught this way and unfortunately was required to take this teacher's Latin class for 2 years in a row. So the first 2 years of my seminary school, freshman and sophomore year, were horrible. Not just because of the Latin teacher, but because the other man who I told the whole story to, expecting to get help, divulged my experience to other priests and brothers. I understand a lot about the story you're having, and I have a tremendous amount of sympathy and empathy for you and identification. So, Ed, you're not alone. It's pretty similar in a lot of ways, and I'm interested in hearing, of course, more. But thank you for being here tonight, Ed.
Well, Bill, thank you for sharing your story as well. I feel the same. My heart goes out to you as well, because it takes a lot of work later on in life sorting these things out. And you know, I think one of the, you know, I'm always looking to be, not just be positive, but you have to find a way to be grateful for your life and enjoy the life that you've given and enjoy the days that go by. And it takes a lot of effort to get there. And I think, you know, the levels of sorrow and pain and depth that we go through to get recovery, by the time we get there, I feel that we have a deeper and greater sense to be grateful for things in life than people who may not have been abused. And that may not be true for everybody, but I know for me, I would not be the person I am today if these things didn't happen. And, it's very sobering, to say the least. You know, when you hear other people's stories, it never gets regular.
Well, I'm sure that as we progress this evening, you're going to talk about, you know, sort of the reaction you had in adolescence and adulthood and how it affected you and so forth, and then eventually your recovery and that. And we'll share along with you whatever is similar in ours, but I can already tell you that it's going to be quite similar because NASCA is a result of that. I mean, frankly, even just the organization, you know, my experiences and my recovery were obviously integral in the creation of a group like a NASCA group. So there you go.
Yep, I can relate to you with my nonprofit. It's a wonderful story. Wonderful story.
Well, we're going to be talking all about what you're doing today very soon. You see, all of us here on NASCA, 99.9% of us, okay, are survivors of child abuse, and a lot of it's sexual. Mine started at the age of 6. And lasted until I was 17, actually. And it was in the family, outside of the family, and all kinds of stuff. So we all understand, you know, here, you know, what it's like to be sexually, physically, mentally, emotionally abused, and in my case, all of those, and neglected. I don't know why I'm still standing, but I am still standing. Probably because, I'll tell you what, it, you know, when children are so abused, they either implode or they explode. And I did implode for a while. I suffered horribly from panic attacks. It actually took over my life, okay, at one point. And I didn't even want to lose, you know, go out of the house. I was agoraphobic. I had to suffer a little bit with that. But I like to shop, Ed. Yes, I do. So I got really mad, okay? I got mad of not wanting to leave the house because I wanted to get out and do things. And I think I was actually helping myself because starting to anger. The anger that I had was actually put in the right place, not angry at myself. Everything I ever saw in my life was volatile. No one ever groomed me. I saw domestic violence at the age of 4 where blood was flying and people were getting punched and knives were being thrown and all kinds of stuff with my mother and my so-called bio father. And then it turned into sexual abuse with a pedophile uncle. And it went on and on and on from there, family members and then outside of the family. So I certainly know about sexual abuse and how it makes you feel, how it affects you physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And it does do, unfortunately, all those things psychologically, every way you can think of. It does affect you. But the good part of the whole thing is if you do get help, and I finally did when I was 30, okay, a church group got a hold of me, and it was a good Catholic church. Yes, it was. And they worked with me because there was over 200 people there in that prayer group. And they come from all walks of life. And there were counselors there, and they said to me, "You're a mess." And I said, "Yes, I am." And they took me, and they worked with me. And they told me I wasn't crazy. I wasn't stupid. Gave me tests, all kinds of things, and told me I should become a counselor. That's what they told me. And I started then working in all different fields and areas of counseling and so forth. But anyway, the point is this. We are not worthless people. Today we know who we are, most of us, hopefully. A lot of people do dissociate. I see that you had that problem. Let's speak a little bit about that. When you said that you dissociated, okay, when do you think you started doing that?
I started doing that at age 4. Very easy question to answer.
I think I sort of like did a little of that too at age 6, because one time I did fight back. And he just about broke my wrist. My wrist has been banged around, believe me. And, go away. So anyway, we're going to have a heavy-duty storm, and they're getting a hold of us. All right. So, but anyway, I started, too, at an early age at 6. And it was a very frightening thing that I went through also. And I think, see, that's the mind's way. When we speak on the show, we educate people. It's the mind's way of sort of like, protection. Look where we are. Look what's happening. And what can we do? Nothing. We are children. And we are victims at that point. And if we live through it, we turn into survivors and thrivers just like yourself. Bill, I'm glad you're on. Because I just got that bing, bing, bing on my cell phone. And if the storm does stop, or start, rather, I wish it would just go away, but you might have to take over. Okay, so anyway, let's go on with your story. So you started to dissociate at the age of 4. And so tell us a little bit more about, were you able to make friends in school? Were you able to concentrate? We ask these questions because so many can't.
Yeah, so I mean... You know, my the dissociation, though, I said yes to your question, but just I would like to answer, like, what does that mean in my experience and how that affected me? Mm-hmm. So when my grandfather would come and molest me, and the same thing happened, I learned to do this with the next-door neighbor and with the teacher as well, is that I would just kind of leave my body in a sense. It was weird. I would, like, just – kind of almost like float up in the air and see, look down on what was happening. It was just so weird to just leave myself and come back when it was over. And that's a very common experience, I know, with survivors. And it was just, you know, it's not something that I practiced or it just came to me naturally at that young of an age. And talk about having an internal mechanism of protection for your mind. That comes naturally. It's really quite something. So what happened for me was, you know, I've been diagnosed with ADHD for many years, and I know. I mean, I'm clinically diagnosed with it, so I've been through all the tests you can possibly get, and there's no question. And I think that's something that runs in our family, but I think it is also something that is enhanced through the abuse that I experienced. So I had. A lot of difficulties in school concentrating. I was always the class clown, or I was just a C+ student. And in my senior years of high school, I began failing. And I, it was just really weird because I would try to fit in wherever anybody would like me, right? So I was athletically inclined, and so I got into sports, and that was great. And then, when I was 12 is when the first time I started smoking marijuana and started drinking. And so I, just on the very beginning of starting high school, I was already exposed to that. So, you know, I was really into sports and really into partying and just, you know, trying to like watch other guys and find out what do they do to be popular. And if you were really great at sports or if you were, you know, just great to be around the party with, that's what I did. And like I said, our parents had a place on the lake. And so water skiing was a big thing for me. And we had, you know, I always had friends out at the lake and we would party there. And as a matter of fact, our graduation party for our graduating class was at that place, was at the lake. And so I was, you know, nobody knew that there was anything wrong or I was just one of the cool guys, you know, I suppose. I mean, maybe I'm just, that's a self-assessment, but, you know, I mean, school was, for me, was fun. I didn't, looking back, I know now that many people in school, they plan for the future. Like, what are you going to do and go to college or, you know, and I didn't have any thinking towards my future in that respect. And I was just lost as far as trying to figure out what am I going to do with myself? Cause I just felt I just wasn't smart enough to, you know, cause if I failed high school, which I did, how the heck am I going to get through college? To me, that would just made sense. And so then I'm going to have to figure out something else to do. So from, you know, when I graduated from age 18 until I was 21, you know, I was just getting jobs everywhere I could and partying and just, it was really like, it was sex, drugs, rock and roll. That's what I was looking for. And that's what I got. And that's what I did. And eventually you burn out, right? You just hit the bottom and you gotta do something. And I ended up going to college out of desperation because I felt like a loser. Right? So I needed, let me see if I can get my grade 12. So everything I did going forward in my life, everything right up until I completely crashed in my late 40s, was me trying to get attention, to make something of myself, not in the healthy sense of what you do in life to, you know, be successful, but it was so people would think I was successful, so people would think something of me, so they would look at me like I was accomplishing something because I looked at other people and that's what they were doing. So it didn't. There was no solid sense of self-worth and knowing who I was. I started going to church when I was 13. My sister took me to a Bible study, and I mean, think about it. That's when I started smoking pot and drinking, and I also started going to church at the same time. And I was sincere at this Bible study. I really believed in God, and I started going to church, and you know, the first thing that came up to me in my mind was, okay, God, why did this happen to me? And so in church, I was pretty angry at God, and whenever there was a chance to, you know, go up front to get prayed for, I went up front to be angry with God and ask him why this happened to me. And, you know, sadly, what ended up happening was because sex was a big part of my life, and I really appreciate what Bill said and you as well, is that when you're that young, when you're 4 years old, it feels good. You like it. I remember looking forward to nap time because I was going to have sex at the time and because it felt good and you feel like you're being loved. And I'm okay with that now. I understand that. But also the identity issues that you were mentioning as well. So during this time from high school until my early 20s, I was like, for some reason, gay men were attracted to me. I would hitchhike, I'd get picked up by a gay man. I would party, gay men would come on to me. They were attracted to me. And I thought I must be gay. Am I gay? Is that how this happens? Is that how this works? Right? And so I didn't, you know, I felt like Bill, I'm like, I didn't know how to process this. I didn't know at the time. So I just kept going, and all I knew was that I liked sex. So by the time I get through high school, and I really got into church, and I thought that was a really good thing to do, and I became a youth leader in the church, and at this time I was going to college, and, I was just taking on a lot of responsibility, and, you know, young people were looking up to me, and I was a leader. But what ended up happening is around, I don't remember the age exactly, but it was my late teens, I started to experiment with going to brothels and starting to pay for sex and experiment in this area. And it got it's a weird progression that happens when your conscience just slowly loses reality and its sense of right and wrong, you know? How can you go to church and in the same day go to a brothel and feel good about yourself? You don't, right? You feel horrible, right? So I began to become self-loathing in my early 20s, and that grew with me throughout my entire life. Just the intense self-loathing and how much I hated myself was is almost unbearable. But on the outside, you didn't see that. It surprises people that have known me all my life to hear that that's how I felt, but it's very true. And it's funny when I can prove it, because when I started recovery, I started getting tattoos, and I never thought I would get tattoos, but I got this one tattoo, and I know my mother doesn't like it, but it's just it's about 6 inches high and about 5 inches wide, and it's a picture of a guy with his head exploding and his brains going everywhere. And mm-hmm. I got that because it reminds me of, it just looks like a disassociated person, right? Where he's just angry, disassociated from himself. He's got mental anguish. He's self-loathing. And underneath it, there's a Greek word that's in English, it stands for storm. And that's how I felt about my life. And that's actually one of the things I did to help me through recovery was it just helped me to identify with, this is the person that I was. It's not the person that I am now. And I don't ever want to forget the person that I was in my recovery. You can't leave memories behind. You can't. They're just there. But learning how to make it part of your story and accepting yourself is what I've worked on doing. But
Let me say something there. Okay. Ooh, you covered a lot of ground. First of all, it's not uncommon. With me, I had girls that made passes at me, okay? And I punched them in the nose. That's what I did. I was a rough kid. You know, you think you're going to mess with me. Well, you're going to get this. Bang! I didn't care. I did that to two of them. And another girl had, when I was working with the Rabbi Leiper's program, Scared Straight, I was working with her brother, and I didn't know that she was gay. It seemed like I was stupid that way. I didn't realize that these people were gay until they made a pass at me. Well, she made a pass at me and brought over alcohol to my house. I started drinking when I was 13, too, okay, just like you, and smoking cigarettes. And I was out on the street. I did a lot of wild stuff. I love bikes. I was on bikes all the time. I love Harleys. I'm just out there, you know, when I can. And so anyway, this girl came over, and she thought she was going to make passes at me and more. Well, I didn't punch her in the nose. She was tougher than me, I could tell. But I pulled a ring off of her finger, and I said, "Now, I'm taking this ring. Now you get out of my house, and this is your punishment." And away she went. So, you know, this happens. It's not as if you're gay. See, I don't believe that, you know, that when you're sexually abused by the same, it can be confusing, by the same sex.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're gay, okay? It just simply doesn't. Either you are or you aren't, okay? And so I became a violent kid. And handled things my way, and that was through, you know, anger. And I, too, was an athlete. I would run, and I would jump the hurdles. And I was a very good athlete, and I won awards for it in school. And I was a musician. I loved to sing. And I would go into the city with my friends, and we were all the same, all dysfunctional homes. Mm. And so that's how we would take our anger and our upset and all kinds of things is either through sports or through going through, you know, to New York City and singing and things like that. I don't regret those days because the singing was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's what's upsetting with the whole thing is like you said, well, you never forget, you know, what happened to you as a child. And no, we don't forget. But what we learn to do, if we're going to move forward, and progress in our lives and become maybe who we're meant to be, okay,
is
we put it in a different place in our mind. I look back at my past, and I can see it's like watching a movie. I see the child, I watch the child, I see all the different things that happen and all the different stages and what that child goes through, but I have absolutely no emotion towards that child because I have detached from that child because that was then and this is now. And I'm able to do that. And that's how I got over that. That's how I get through my days, is that was then and this is now. And we are, yes, still standing. So, you know, it does affect us, though, while we're going through the many years of our lives, you know, until we do come to that point where we're able to look at that time and say, damn it, I wish that hadn't happened. And I personally don't forgive those people because they knew what they were doing. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's how everyone has to look at their own way of thinking about
that's
whether
right.
they forgive people or not. And that's a whole different subject. And as far as God is concerned, the way that I look at God is God made us and he gave us free will. Okay. And, you know, it says right in the Bible that you don't hurt children and that children are a gift.
Yeah.
So I believe now that when in heaven and hell, I believe that if you've been as good as you can be, and we're not judged just by our deeds alone, but if you at least are a good person to the best that you can be to your ability, okay, you're going to have a good time in front of God. If you're like Hitler, my husband was Jewish, he's passed now, but he told me all kinds of wild stories, and of course they were all true. But if you're someone like him, or if you're like Jeffrey Dahmer, okay, you know, so I wouldn't want to see them up in heaven, okay? No, that wouldn't work. But so often people do blame God, and God makes us as we are, and we do as we do. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's go on now with your story. Where you're mentioning how, yes, when you were a teenager, you got into all kinds of drugs and alcohol, and then you went through your college years. And let me ask you, did you ever get married, or what's going on with that? Do you have a family? What's going on?
Yeah, so I was, I think, you know, one of the highlights, I don't talk about this as often as I used to anymore, but one of the, because I couldn't decide what to do with my life getting out of college, I thought, well, I really love to water ski. I really love,
mm-hmm.
and I was good at barefoot water skiing. And in Canada, where I was from originally, barefoot water skiing is a very rare skill to have. And so, long story short, when I got out of college, I went to West Palm Beach, Florida, and I lived and worked and trained with at the time, he was the world champion and the U.S. barefoot water ski team captain. And we are friends to this day. And he was my best man at my wedding party. It's kind of my round the way of getting to your question. So I did get married when I was 30, and he was my best man. And we were married for 13 years, and we got divorced in 2009. And it was, it was just, we had troubles all the way through. I thought, and I know this isn't uncommon either, I thought getting married to a beautiful girl, that will fix my sexual addiction problems. Well, you know, that is not the answer for sexual addiction. And so, you know, I cheated on my wife, and she knows that today. And I've, after we got divorced, she didn't know this until afterwards. In order for me to share this story publicly, it was only fair that I shared it with her first and let her know these things. So she knows these things. And it's very shameful and very embarrassing for me to share that story now. But I'm a huge proponent of sharing our stories openly and vulnerably and getting the shame out, and especially for men, because we hide these things. And so what ended up happening was I was very much a go-getter, so to speak. I was, you know, instead of ready, aim, fire, I was fire, aim, ready. I did everything backwards. I was like, act now and figure out the situation later. And so I ended up getting a job with a consulting company, a technology consulting company, and with only the equivalent of an associate's degree in college, I ended up making a six-figure income and consulting for some of the largest companies on the planet and helping them improve their IT business processes. Companies like the Boeing Corporation and pharmaceutical companies in Europe and Wells Fargo and just all these high-level big companies where I really felt, that gave me a sense of gave me a sense of value, and it gave me a sense of, hey, I'm accomplishing something, so this is kind of the answer to what I'm looking for. I don't need to think about my past anymore. I'm a successful person. But the problem was, when I started making this kind of money, if you're a sex addict, well, what do you think you're going to do with the money? You're going to spend it on your addiction. And so I started spending money on my addiction everywhere I traveled, because I traveled, if I was traveling within North America, I was averaging 25,000 miles a year. And when I was traveling overseas, I was 40 to 50,000 miles a year and a pocket full of cash. And I would spend it on paying for sex. And that's another part of my story I wish I didn't have, but it's there. And it's not uncommon, man. And it's something I like to speak to and, in the right, as is appropriate, like on a radio show like this. And so,
you can say anything you. This is an adult show, and you can say anything you want on this show. Go ahead. Don't feel like you have to hold back or this type of thing, because we lay it out the way it is. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know you guys do. I was excited to get invited onto the show to be able to do this, and so that's what happened. So the further I went, the more I hated myself. Right? I just absolutely despised who I was as a human being. Yet here I was making a six-figure income and traveling the world, and I got this sexy career, and it's just I talked it up, and that's who I was. That's where my identity came from. And what ended up happening while I was traveling doing this work, it's very stressful work, and the majority. This is really strange to say, but if you've ever seen the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio called Catch Me If You Can, it's about a real-life story about a guy who pretended to be an airline pilot, he pretended to be a surgeon, and he pretended to be a doctor, and he got away with it for years. Well,
I think I remember that. Go ahead. Yeah.
So, when I put my resume in to get this job, I kind of faked my resume a lot, and I literally Googled my career. I Googled how do you do this, and I learned from people around me and from things that were working and things that weren't, because you don't get paid that kind of a salary to work at those levels within companies. I was working with the CIO and the CEOs and directors. It was a major enterprise change that I was implementing here, and to do that with no experience and no certification, it came from being more ballsy than it was from being educated. And so it really boosted my confidence, but it was a shell, right? It was a shell, and I didn't realize that. And so this is a very interesting story that I'm going to share with you now that I think is something that a lot of survivors go through, and these are triggering events. And one day when I was in Toronto, and this is, I was working for a client there, and I was really enjoying a wonderful dinner at an Italian restaurant, and and having a great time. The weather was great, and then I was walking home to my hotel room and just really enjoying the moment. And as I was just crossing the street, it was like a major intersection in downtown Toronto, so there's lights and people crossing, pedestrians and whatnot. And as I'm crossing the walk, a taxi was trying to, kind of edge through the people and trying to turn right. And, that's not uncommon. That's what happens in traffic in big cities. And this guy kind of cut it a little bit close to me. Like, it was just a little bit too close for comfort for me. He kind of just brushed my legs as he went by, and it was really nothing. But what happened in an instant is I went crazy in a sense. I just lost my temper in such a way that I started beating the back of his taxi cab while he was waiting for people to get out of the way of the front of him. He couldn't move. And I was double fisting, pounding the back of his trunk and literally denting the back of it. And it was like out of a movie, watching somebody just try to destroy a car. And he got out angry, and he was like, you know, yelling at me to stop beating his car. And I can look back on it and remember thinking, what are you doing? Like, what is going on here? Why are you doing this? This isn't who I am. And, you know, I yelled at him you have to picture it like it's in a movie. It's very intense. And I threatened him. I said, you know, if you want to make it home to your family, if you got a family, or if you want to live past the next 5 minutes, you're going to want to get in your car and you're going to want to get out of here, because one of us is leaving alive right now. And I can tell you, it's not going to be you. And I couldn't believe the words that were coming out of my mouth. And he was scared. He got back in his cab and he drove away. And then I just felt everything came down, you know, the adrenaline. And I walked into the hotel. I got into my elevator. I was looking in the mirror and just like absolutely bewildered as to what had just happened. And so that kind of an outburst happened, let's say, a couple of times a year it happened. And it's just, I wasn't really aware that they were happening, and I just kind of got used to them happening. And I didn't know what it was, but now I do, and it's part of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. That is
That's right.
Symptom of that. Yes.
And it's complex PTSD, because when you've been sexually abused, or it could be any sort of abuse, it's trauma. This is what we're speaking about, is trauma. When it happens time after time after time, then it becomes complex. And, of course, that's what you've been through. I've been through it. Bill's been through it. A lot of us have been through it. And it becomes then complex. So your body, you know, stored up so much anger and so much, I'm sure there was hatred. I had hatred in me, for sure. I can't speak for you. But, you know, I had so much anger that all this stuff yes. could happen, you know, to one little girl yes. and go through life and not having to steal her clothes. I came from a wealthy home. What are you, crazy? All kinds of stuff. And all the other dysfunction that went along with it within the family unit. Many times that's where the problem starts, is within the family unit, and that's what needs to be looked at. I worked in detention center. Those kids had a similar past as you and me, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you
that's
and
right.
I.
That's right.
Okay, they came from total dysfunction. And so therefore, the way that they behaved, well, they turned into juvenile delinquents. Some were in foster care, and they ran away because they were being abused there, and others were just being, I don't mean just, they were being abused at home and ended up out on the street. Which is more the type of thing that I did. So, look, it has to go somewhere, okay?
That's right. That's
we
right.
Pen,
that's right.
This is why I say implode or explode. And when you explode, you just plain it, let it out, you know. And I remember not having too much identification myself, not sexually. I always knew that I liked guys. I always knew that. But I didn't know who I was as a person, and I would feel my face, and I would feel numb. I know what you're talking about, when you didn't know who the heck you were. So you would do all of these things, whether it be through jobs or all the places you traveled the world wide, you did this, and it made you feel better. It made you feel good, but still there was that inside inner anger that was boiling up like a volcano. And you had to explode, and you would do that several times a year. That's where it comes from. Yes, I agree with that. Let me see if Bill has something to say about it. Plus, we have Roberta from Oklahoma. Let me see if I'll go to her first, because I haven't spoken to her yet tonight. I have her mic open. Okay, Roberta, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, thank you. How are y'all?
Well, we're doing okay. Yeah, you came in a little late, but that's okay. He's got quite a story here, and I'm really quite proud of him, okay? And he has his own foundation, which we're going to get into very shortly. So I thank you for calling in, and maybe I'll talk to you later, okay?
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, hon. Okay, let's go to Bill here, because I want to get to his foundation. Okay, Bill, is there something you want to ask, a question, or make a comment?
Well, there's an awful lot that's been shared so far, and I don't know exactly what would be most helpful to the listener. I'll share that I understand and feel the the emotional states and the not the inability to pay attention in school, and all of that. Also, you know, I was very angry at God, whose representatives are supposed to be the clergy that were, you know, leading the church. And here I felt really let down and disappointed. No, more, way more than disappointed. Very, very hurt. And frankly, enraged. My way back to having a spiritual life took a while because I, you know, I was extremely off-put by the Catholicism anyway, certainly that. And I was able, at the end of my my high school years, to have two good years after two horrible years, which enabled me to get accepted by several universities. And I ended up at the University of Toronto, by the way. I know Toronto very well. The rage that you're describing, certainly I had that in me. I tried to control my rage by my drinking and drugging and my women. So, and I grew up in the era, you know, sort of the late hippie era, if you want, where sex, drugs, and rock and roll comes from. And there wasn't any need to go to prostitution houses. We were very kind of free with our sexuality. So a lot of, I went through a lot of women in that period of time in the state of 10 to 12 years between, you know, my college years and my all my 20s. I identify with all this stuff very, very heavily. And it's not unusual. As Carol was saying, these are reactions to the trauma. We all have whatever reactions we have. They're not always identical, but they are quite similar. And they frequently involve obsessions. They frequently involve addictions. They frequently involve the decision-making process that we were kind of brought up to understand, and whatever was shared with us when I was young, which was very little, by the way. I wasn't taught about life at all. But we begin to make terrible decisions, and we make terrible relationship choices and all of this, on and on and on. So I'm very much in identification, Ed, with everything you said and in agreement with it. And I really, again, appreciate your being here. I know you've had a lot of experience in sharing, so I don't need you to understand me, but I just want you to know we understand you, and I hope the newcomer will listen to tonight's show, not identifying with the facts of what Ed's gone through or any of us have gone through, but the feelings, because that's what we have in common, the feelings, the choices, the decisions, the emotional state. These are what we have in common. Again, not 100% all of us, but so similar. That's where the similarities really apply. And if you identify with that, if you're out there listening tonight, Ed's doing this simply because he hopes that you'll come back again. That's it. You know, or check out the website. Or, you know, call some of us. We have a big contact list on the website and so forth. Get involved when you're ready. But hopefully Ed's kind of testimony tonight will make you understand that, geez, if Ed can talk about all that stuff and so honestly and so transparently, maybe I can tell my story someday too. And that's pretty much as simple as it gets. Yeah. Well, thanks,
yeah,
no,
I love what you're saying, Bill, because I think when you find out that you're not alone in your experience, although your experiences, they vary in how we react and how they form and shape us. But, you know, when I went through recovery, it was just so, it just felt so good finding out that what I'm going through is not uncommon, and I don't need to be ashamed of it, although you it's okay that you do, because it is shameful. But when you connect with other survivors, and I think for me, I think that that is one of the most powerful things that we can do is connect with other survivors. And when we finally get to the place where we can start sharing our story, even if it's just in little bits, because it takes a while to be able to really talk about the whole thing. And you know, it's nothing I take or approach that in a cavalier type of way. But I've decided that part of my personality is I like to have fun. I like to encourage people. I like to motivate people. And, you know, I was like, well, how do you do that in this topic area. And you know, we'll talk about that as we get onto my nonprofit and whatnot. But the reality is you can get your life back. You can live. You can love. You can laugh. You can enjoy. And there is some shore on the other side of the waters that you're going through. And that's what I love about your organization, is just how it connects with other people on a real level. And I really appreciate you saying those things and having me here today.
No, we'd love having you here. And I'm thankful that you're being so open and honest, too. Because, you know, if we're not open and honest, okay, we're not telling their story complete. And also, too, we're sort of like, we're not going to move forward, because that means there's things that are bothering us. There's always going to be parts in our life that are going to bother us, okay? But it's how we express ourselves and how we handle it. And we learn how to do that as time goes by. We just simply do. So let's get down to your nonprofit. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, what you're doing today. You says here, I have a tremendous amount of gratitude and thanksgiving to be alive and for who I've become. See, there is life after abuse. I keep telling people that. There is life after abuse. And helping others, Ed runs a nonprofit organization, and it's called Me Too, What Now, okay, and has a YouTube channel. This is wonderful. I'm so glad that you've gotten this far, that you're doing so well. Why don't you tell us about it? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that really kind of organically happened that I never really, I didn't, you know, it was a kind of just naturally came out of my recovery. And so I have to kind of back up a little bit and talk about what happened before I started it, right? So,
sure.
I got my divorce in 2019, so I was really at a low place in my life. Sorry, I don't know what I just said there. 2009 is when I got my divorce. What ended up happening was I just started going all out. You know, I'm not married anymore, so I can do what I want. So it was just a very untethered, unleashed time where I just, you know, I went crazy doing whatever I wanted to do, and not a lot of it was good. And so, you know, it's kind of like the story in the Bible of the prodigal son, right? He goes out and just does everything he wants, and then he finds himself in a pig pen and ends up coming home. And so when I crashed, and when I mean by crashed is that, on my job, I would get off work, I would get a bottle of wine, and I was taking prescription medications. I was on Adderall for my ADHD. I was on sleep meds. I'd been on sleep meds for years because of all the different time zones and traveling overseas that I did. And just, I was so emotionally distraught, and I was losing my ability to concentrate and focus on my job. And so I just started having this downward spiral that nobody saw. And, you know, I started having panic attacks and these kinds of things. And then one day, and this was in 2015, so it's not that long ago. This is only barely 6 years ago. In 2015, I was in a Starbucks, and I was with a friend. And he had a nonprofit organization called the Brotherhood of Men, and he helped men who were going through divorce just to get their lives back on track. And, you know, if you had kids, I mean, that was really a big part of what he does and still does today. And he helps men manage through being a father and going through divorce. And part of what they deal with, too, is men who are, you know, have sex addiction problems or pornography problems and all these things that men deal with. And so, you know, I met him. He was a fairly new friend. And, you know, one day he just went for coffee and he said, you know, Ed, so tell me your story. And I thought, you know what, I've never told anyone my whole story. For years, I was open to talking about, you know, I was sexually abused by my grandfather, step-grandfather, my teacher, and all these things, but I never shared the stories about, you know, being a sex addict or being addicted to pornography or paying for sex and going to massage parlors and all this heavy, dark, shameful stuff that I did. So I felt, you know, I kind of covered myself in a sense. I felt kind of, in a sense, a little bit prideful in the sense that, yeah, I'm not afraid to talk about my past. Well, for the most part, but I'm not going to talk about the things that are really, really shameful to me.
And people do that. Go ahead.
Well, we do, right? We compartmentalize our trauma. And that's okay, right? It's okay. I think the more you talk about any part of it, at some point it's going to open up neurological pathways to the whole thing coming out. And I think life life has a really strange way of making those opportunities happen for us. Like, how is it that I met a stranger that this is what he did? We sat in Starbucks, asked me that question, and I felt safe with him. And so it all came out, right? I told him everything. It felt so good telling someone for the first time everything that I did. And, you know, Zach sat there and he just listened. You know, he didn't react. He wasn't shocked at anything that I had to say. And I thought he would. I mean, I just thought, you know, because I'm such a horrible person, listen to what I did. I did all these horrible things. And he just listened. And at the very end, he said, Ed, I just really want to thank you for sharing your story with me. And I'd like to hear more. But I have to go, and I just really appreciate that. And I was like, okay, well, great. That was awesome. And he left, and I sat there, and I just felt like a huge weight come off my shoulders, you know. And then my life started to kick off in a way that I could never have planned in a million years. Sitting beside me, there was a group of young people from, they were seniors from a local Christian high school, and they were planning an event it was going to be the first year, like an inaugural event that they were going to do every year in a senior class of their high school, where the seniors would take on a project and they would put on a community event. So they would go through the exercises of understanding what is the process of event planning, project planning, and doing these things. And they got graded on it, and they actually put on an event. And so they got to choose what they wanted to do. And so here's all these, you know, handful of 18-year-old senior young ladies and young men and their teacher, and they're talking in a circle. You could tell they were planning something. So when my Zach left, this girl leans over and she says to me, "Excuse me, sir, I don't mean to make it sound like I was eavesdropping, but were you just talking to your friend there about sex trafficking and prostitution?" And I was shocked that she overheard me. Right? I was really disturbed that someone heard my story. And I felt like I was caught red-handed in a sense. Like, what am I supposed to do, say no or lie, start lying? For the first time in my life, I'm not lying. I have to tell the truth. So I just kind of fumbled through her answering her, and I said, I wasn't talking about, you know, sex trafficking. I say it like I'm not that bad of a person. I was talking about prostitution, yeah, so it was only that. And it was just a very awkward situation for me, right? And she says, "Well, we're planning a local community event where some of these topics are what we're doing. Would you mind sharing your story with us like you just did with your friend?" And I'm thinking, no, I am not going to do that. I didn't say that, but I'm thinking, no, I don't want to do that. I'm just trying to get over the fact that I did it once with someone. I don't want to sit here with a bunch of high school kids and their teacher and tell you guys what I just told my friend. But there's so much power in, you know, when we do tell someone, right, just someone
Absolutely.
That you trust,
yeah.
to really get it all out. I believe that what happened in that coffee shop was supposed to happen for me. It was supposed to happen. And you know, be careful when you share your story. If you're not comfortable sharing it in a public area where you could be overheard, then don't, right? I didn't think I would be, but life will begin to happen. And here's the thing I love about life, and the thing I love about recovery is the things that have happened to me since the very first day I told my story for the very first time, and that was in 2015 in November. So I leaned over and I said, "Well, what can I share?" So I told them pretty much what I've been sharing with you on the show. I thought I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it for a second time in a row right now. So I did, and the teacher, he says to the students, he says, you see, everybody, I told you, God will answer our prayers, and he will bring the people in our path that are meant to be here. And I looked at him, and I was thinking, you think I was brought into your path as an answer to your prayer? I think you are highly mistaken, because this is as far as this goes, as far as my participation in whatever it is that you're doing. I'm not interested in being a part of your community event. For me, it was huge just telling my friend Zach. Now I'm telling you guys, that's it. I'm good. And I shared that with him too. I said, I don't they asked me to come and speak at their event. And the event is now, you can look at it on the internet. It's called shift.org. And they have a regular yearly event, and they advocate against child sex trafficking and these kinds of things. So long story short, I agreed to come and speak at their event in May of 2016. And just shortly before I spoke at that event, I was contacted by a friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine, Heather Young, and she lived down the street from me, her and her brother Jim. And Jim was we grew up together and had birthday party. We were just friends growing up and playmates. And we were sexually abused by the same teacher. And when Jim was 27, I think he was 27, 29, he ended up committing suicide. And he took a shotgun to his head in the basement of his parents' home. And I was living in Florida at the time, barefoot water skiing with my friend Steve. And when I heard about it, I ignored that news and that information because I knew in my heart why he did it. And I didn't want to face that. So here it is, decades later. And Heather calls me. She says, look, I wrote a book about Jim, and I would love if you would come to Prince George, which was my hometown that we grew up in. She said, would you come and speak at a book signing and a book reveal event that I'm going to do, and the local community is going to be there and all this stuff. And I didn't want to go do that either. And I decided to do it. So within 2 weeks of both events, I spoke at one event here in Denver. There was 1,000 people there. And then I spoke at home in Canada, and there's, I don't know, 150 people there. And that my life just began to seriously change.
Isn't that a good thing? Now, you're talking about presentations, okay? And when you do presentations, you get stronger. And each time you do it, because I've done many, it makes you feel good about what you're doing. You have to judge your audience. Some people, you'll see them squirming really around. And one kid, for God's sake, one of the universities that I spoke at, he got up and left. He was crying.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, what we have to say touches so many people. It's a good thing, though, and it does strengthen us. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when it comes to this sort of thing, I didn't do this under the direction and advice and help from a therapist, and I highly recommend that if you're going to do what I did. I've been public speaking over the years in my job, and I thought, I can do this. I think this would be a good thing. It'll be hard, but I had no idea the impact it was having on me neurologically, and literally I was just developing post-traumatic stress disorder while I was doing it, not being aware of that, and then being very, having a lot of difficulties afterwards in trying to manage what I was doing. So on top of that, what ended up happening was there's a documentary journalist in Canada who heard about my story, and I knew him actually from years ago growing up, so it wasn't somebody who was a stranger, but he called me up out of the blue and said, hey, Ed, he works for the CBC in Canada, and he wanted to do an independent documentary that had nothing to do with the CBC, but he was a very well-renowned journalist and news reporter, and he wanted to do a documentary on what are the long-term effects of childhood sexual abuse on adults. Would you be interested in participating in that? So that was the third thing that came up all within about the same time, and I thought, well, okay, I might as well. I'm already talking, so if I can do that and help, and it'll help me, then great. So when I landed in Canada for this book signing event, his documentary team was waiting there for me, and from the time I landed at the airport until 4 or 5 days later, I had this documentary team following me around and filming my life story and everything, and it was it kicked off a series of events that involved lawsuits, and I decided to pursue a lawsuit against the school board back in Canada and the teacher, because thankfully there's no statute of limitations there. And so that's a really big step as well. And for me, it kind of falls under the topic of, it's a whole different thing to pursue a legal avenue, just like it's a whole different topic to talk about forgiveness. You can't kind of do it in one show. But I decided to pursue the legal action, And I decided to do it publicly, meaning I didn't mind having my name out there and the newspapers and radios and people contacting me. And so I went for it because I thought, you know what, I am angry, right? I if there's justice that can happen here, sign me up, right? I don't care what happens to me or what people think. I don't care. That my friend Jim killed himself, and if there's anything I can do. So I got on this. I just started feeling empowered to be able to do something, and I had the ability to do something because of what had happened to me, right? So that's a powerful thing that you can do with your story, and it's something you can do. It's like what you're doing. It's like what Bill is doing. We're taking our past and doing something for good that's impacting. I can't think of anything else. There's a small handful of topics on this planet that are more important than everything else, and this is one of them. I feel like I'm privileged to be – I can't think of anything else I would rather do, to be honest with you. So
mission. Let me say something here. This is our mission, is to help people and to get the awareness out and help the people to understand society. This is a societal area type thing that we're speaking about. Because people will walk by, they see kids get smacked, they don't do anything. They know kids in four or five houses down on the block on the street, they're getting abused, they keep their mouths shut. No. It's time for us to fight back, and people have to understand what it does and how it affects society. Why do you think the prisons are so full? And then detention center, these kids, and then they turn into prisoners. What happens? They go out and they commit crimes. And a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them had been abused like we have. I've got to get on a little bit faster here. I'll tell you why. Because we haven't gotten a chance to say, I want people to know that you have published work, okay? You've written a book called World Changes. And we're almost done with the show. This is why I have to push ahead a little bit here. World Changers, in collaboration with an author from South Africa, which is in the final stages of the publishing process, and I congratulate you on that. I often speak as often as I can to other advocacy groups, nonprofit organizations like us, as well as podcasting. You have your own podcast, do you not? Do I see that here? As well as podcasting and social media summits, since I'm heavily invested in social media and I have a podcast of my own. You are a busy guy.
Yes. Yes, I am. Yes.
Yeah. So, is that because you're like hyperactive? I don't know.
Absolutely.
I think that's great.
Absolutely. You know, I'm single. I don't have any children. I don't have a wife. I've got time on my hands. So I'm taking all the experience I've had from being a corporate, a high-level consultant and businessman and applying it to all the things that I'm doing. I have fallen in love with filmmaking, so my YouTube channel is a big thing. I'm producing. I've been in the process of producing a documentary about this story about my lawsuit for the last couple of years, and that's going to still go on for a while. And I just finished a new ebook, and I was hoping to have it available for download off my website today, but it should be like tomorrow or Monday or after the show airs, it'll be available. And this is something I'm very proud of. It's called Your Ultimate Guide to Overcoming Childhood Trauma and Abuse, Breakthrough Shame and Deception, Overcome Your Biggest Fears, and Restore Your Dignity and Identity. And I'm very excited to get that. It's free, and I'm very excited to get that in the hands of people that are looking to overcome their challenges and their trauma and from another survivor's perspective. And so with my podcast and my website and the nonprofit and the YouTube channel, the documentary, I'm busy and loving every moment of my life right now.
You bet. You see, you have a purpose. You found yourself, okay? Because as we're going throughout life and we're going through all this terrible abuse that we've all gone through, many of us, okay, we don't know who we are. We don't know what we're supposed to be doing. We have no direction from the people in the family who are supposed to be guiding us as to what we should, look at in life, what's good, what's bad. And I always call it the good, the bad, and the ugly, like that movie that was so funny, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But when it applies to, I don't know if you saw that, that was so funny. But I don't know if you, when you put that and apply that towards child abuse, I mean it just like that. The good, there are good people. There's bad people, and they do ugly things. A lot of times they're ugly. That's exactly what they are. And they screw up our minds so much, our spirits so much. We have to grow ourselves up. We lost our childhood. You
That's
lost
right.
your childhood.
That's
I lost
exactly
my
right.
childhood. Mm-hmm. Bill yeah. and Roberta and Adrian on the show here, they all lost their childhood, you know. And so I always tell my kids, I always tease them. I say, hey, I'm getting to the age, man, I might go into my second childhood. I'm going to have fun. you know, I got to have a childhood somewhere, you know. Come
absolutely.
On now.
Yes.
So,
yes.
you know, absolutely is right. But people out there do not realize just how much the gravity, just how much it does affect us as people, as human beings, as children growing up, trying to become adults. And look at all the things you had to go through before you found yourself and your mission in life, okay? And I'm so proud of you that you've gotten as far as you've gotten because you have, you know, written a book, okay? You're involved with that. You have your own podcast. You are involved with filmmaking. You're involved with all and of course presentations. You're involved with so many, many different things to bring forth that awareness. Now, look, I wrote my book way back in 2008 and got it republished again in 2010 because they said my book was too volatile in 2008, and then their law firm got a hold of it, and then Author House picked me up. Yeah. They were writing about vacations and birds and bees. I don't know, whatever. And so I had to stand up and talk about my book. And, oh, my God, you're going to hear a pin drop. No one wanted to hear about this, you know. So then Author House picked me up. And I went from there. It's all over the world, my book. It's even, it was written in Japanese, for God's sake. And they didn't even ask me my permission. And I get yeah, and I get no money for it, and I don't care.
Yes,
you see,
yeah,
I don't care. I don't get anything for it. A lot of people don't. They sued Author House. In fact, I'll say it publicly because it was public, because they were not getting their money for the books, okay? They just simply weren't. One guy got a check for 90 cents. He was online. 90 cents.
Well, I'm sorry about that. So
that's ridiculous.
I'm laughing. Because
so
I mean,
be careful when you're publishing a book. You better get a hold of the right publishing company, okay?
Yes.
So
I
didn't know how to write a book or whatever. I just did it. I did my book in 28 days. It had 314 pages, and it's all over the place. And many companies are selling my book, and I'm not getting any money for it, no. And I don't care because this is my mission here at NASCA and places when I can do presentations because I do that well, and I've had many, a couple hundred here and a couple hundred there at times. And I've also taught classes inside of universities because people want to become social workers and they don't have the right information. So what could be better than a survivor who has some education, absolutely, and then put it together and work with the professors. So this is how we do things. We have poetry, we have music, we have our books, we have our presentations, we have all different ways of trying to make, you know, society open up their eyes and realize how it does affect them. Because the worst thing that I overhear and hear too many times myself is, well, I'm sorry that Johnny's down the street that you know, that he's turned bad and all this stuff, but that would never happen to my kid, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry that he got sexually abused because that would never happen to my kid. How many kids do not tell? There are 60 million American adult survivors of sexual abuse in this country alone today that we know of because many people do not tell. So when you come on this show and you have your own podcast, you're doing a great thing. You are educating the public, and this is what we need so badly to do. So thank you so much for coming on. We have about 4 minutes. I'm going to leave you the last 4 minutes to give us some final words. What people need to hear who are listening through their computers right now because they're bashful about coming on, or they'll listen later to the archives because this is being recorded as we speak. They need to hear hope and also, too, how to get a hold of you if they want to. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I would, I love the ebook that I just created, and that would be the best thing for them. I recommend, I mean, you can find me, if you type in Me Too, What Now, all one word, in the anywhere, Google or in through iTunes or through on YouTube, you'll find my work or my name, Ed Squire. I'm all over the place. That when you go to my website, not right now, but after this in the archives, you can download my free ebook. It's always going to be available on my homepage. That's not going to change. And there's the information for survivors written from a survivor and the things that I learned in my journey. And I have what I've developed is the five stages of recovery to help kind of build a roadmap for survivors to give them some direction on like how do I handle this, and so I just share a lot of my story along with the things I learned through therapy and on my own research to get me to where I am today. That particular publication and my ongoing work on my YouTube channel is where I always recommend people to go, because I'm trying to take a contemporary approach to this, because I like to have fun, but I don't dismiss the seriousness of the topic. But I want, I'm trying to just show that there is life after trauma, where you can live and be and enjoy yourself and love yourself. And that's what the Visible Kindness podcast is all about. That's the name of the podcast, Visible Kindness. Who would have thought of that, of being a survivor of sexual abuse, coming up with that kind of a podcast? But I did. And it's touching a lot of people, and it's my guests that are touching a lot of people. And the big thing for me is telling people that it's your story and your ability to have that opportunity to share it with somebody as soon as you're able to, right? And there's no rush. You need to process what you hear. Someone like myself who's excited and I'm energetic about my story and what I'm doing, and it didn't always feel that way. Life has been really dark for quite a while before I got here, but it's really exciting to get on the other side. You know, I've heard that saying, if you find yourself walking through hell, keep going, because you'll get through it on the other side at some point. And there's people there cheering you on. And one of the things I like to do is, like NASCA does, is I make myself available for people to contact me. So I enjoy either being on the phone or doing a FaceTime or Zoom or anything I can do, or, you know, if it's through direct messaging, I make myself available to connect with survivors as often as I can. And I really appreciate you having me on your show. And I'm looking forward to interacting with NASCA more in the future as we go. I've been heads down doing a lot of creating recently and haven't been interacting as much as I would. And I look forward to it, and I just really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let me tell you something, Ed. You're welcome. I mean, you are a family member now that you told your story, and you have so much to offer, okay? I love it when guests come on like yourself who have so much to give, okay, and they love giving, because, you see, that's one thing. Even though we were denied as children, certainly, in every aspect we were denied, as far as child mental development and so forth, how to become this and that, we did okay, all right? We did fine. We're here. And, you know, everyone, too, if they learn how to, you know, what's important, what's not important, get rid of toxic people in your life. Don't let I don't worry about family members. I don't worry about that stuff anymore. And, you know, all these things, because that's very, very important. So there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There absolutely is. And, you know, thank you so much for being here, because you have a very upbeat way about you. I like that. I was a clown, too. I still am. But also very serious at the same time, okay, because this is serious business. And so we can help a lot of people. Yes, we can, yes. Just by being who we are. And that's called survivors, okay? So I'm going to have to close this show in just a second. And, 90 seconds I have. So anyway, come on. We're here Monday through Friday. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we have people to tell a story, just like you did tonight, okay? And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we have the survivor / professionals, whatever. They could be psychiatrists. They could be therapists, whatever. And they come on, and people are, you know, call in and ask them any type of question that they might have about trauma that they're going through, whatever it is. So we have a full week. That's Monday through Friday. And so welcome to all, and I want to thank you so much, you know, for coming on. And I'll be waiting to hear from you again, you bet. Yes, sir.
Well, that sounds really good. Thank you very much again. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. So I have to say goodnight now to everybody. And we're here, you're here, and please don't be a stranger, okay? Okay.
Right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Blog Talk Radio.